Now to soaring food prices and how some people are using their green thumbs to save some green. Matt Schaefer-Powell of member station WUOT reports.
Ann Parks Johnson's flower beds look a little different this year. They don't have many flowers in them.
I've got broccoli and kohlrabi, and I just put the tomatoes in. And then I have garlic.
The retired school teacher from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, does love flowers. But the decision to fill her flower beds with vegetables was an economic one.
We were heading into, let's call it a recession, and I decided that I probably need to raise more vegetables.
Ann Parks Johnson isn't alone. The National Gardening Association says Americans spent $1.4 billion on vegetable gardens last year. That's an increase of almost 25% from 2006. And research from the Garden Writers Association shows that trend will continue this year. Richard Miners owns the Pine Tree Garden Seed Company, a national seed distributor based in Maine.
We've seen about a 20% increase. By the end of the year, we could be talking about an extra $250,000.
Miners has sold seeds for almost three decades, and it no longer surprises him to see vegetable seed sales go up during poor economic times.
Over these 29 years, I would say they have always been inversely related. People's expectations of the economy. When they're looking grimmer, our sales tend to get better.
Now, forecasting economic trends is a lot more complicated than just looking into our backyard gardens. Economists use hundreds of indicators, and a spike in vegetable gardening may not be related to the economy at all. But the last time Americans showed so much interest in planting vegetables was 2001, during the last recession.
That may not be a very bad indicator of what the economy may do.
That's Matt Murray, an economist with the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Tennessee.
If you look at the reality of where the economy is in an economic downturn, people are losing their jobs, people are having their hours curtailed, their income is down. From just an income perspective, there is a constraint on the budget and there is an incentive for people to do some homegrown gardening.
Back at her Oak Ridge, Tennessee home, Ann Parks Johnson says she'll get back to planting more flowers in due time. This year, she figures she'll save about $1,500 by planting her own vegetables. But aside from the money, she says she loves the taste, the safety, and the excuse to go play outside.
It's like digging in the sand pile, you know, for kids and to watch things grow. Just really rewarding.
So while economic forecasters might be wise to watch her garden, Ann Parks Johnson will be watching forecasters of a different kind.
Look at all the rain off to our west moving through Middle Tennessee. If you're traveling 40 westbound, you'll get into some rain as you get closer to Nashville.
For NPR News, I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell in Knoxville.
Palm oil is everywhere. It's in our soap, our makeup, lots and lots of food products. The American Palm Oil Council, yes, there is such a thing, says it's actually good stuff. They say it doesn't have any trans fats. It's rich in antioxidants. Those are good things. Increases good cholesterol and may, in fact, prevent the growth of some cancer cells, so they say. And it's now being processed into a cheap, supposedly cleaner, plant-based biofuel. But when we read an opinion piece by writer Glenn Hurwitz in this week's LA Times, we learned that some folks think it's wrecking the environment. Palm plantations, predominantly in Southeast Asia, are created by burning peatland. That emits serious greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Critics also say that the palm plantations are occupying the last remaining habitats for some endangered species, like the rhino and orangutan. So we like the environment. We like animals. But I gotta say, when we were talking about this one, some of us thought, okay, how does this affect me? We are inundated with environmental and health do's and don'ts. Feels like every day some new news story tells us some bad effect that some product is having on the environment. It's hard to keep up. That's how we arrived at this edition of the BPP's recurring series, Make Me Care, where we look at news stories you get the feeling you should pay attention to, but you just don't really want to. You don't know why. We ask an expert to tell us why a story is indeed worth paying attention to. Today on deck is Rolf Skaar. He's a senior forest campaigner with Greenpeace. Hey, Rolf.
How's it going?
It goes well. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So you heard that long intro. You have 60 seconds to play this game and explain to us why we should care about palm oil and the supposed effect that palm oil has on the environment. When you hear the ticking clock, you have just 10 seconds left. Do you think you understand?
Yeah, I'm ready to go.
You think you're ready? Okay, Rolf, make me care. Go.
Well, Rachel, the fastest and the worst deforestation rate in the history of humankind is taking place in the tropical forests of Indonesia right now. That record-breaking rainforest destruction is being fueled by the clearing of land to make palm oil, a substance that's in products we use every day, from candy bars to shampoos to laundry detergents. Now, much of that forest destruction, some 70 to 80% of it, is illegal, and it comes with a heavy price tag. It's causing gross human rights abuses. It's pushing wildlife like the orangutan and the Sumatran tiger towards extinction. It's emitting massive amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, putting at risk the climate that we all depend on. But the good news is it doesn't need to be that way, because with simple actions and with everyday choices, we can put a quick end to this problem. But the first step is education. So now do you want to learn more?
Okay, Rolf, the verdict is you beat the 60-second clock. Good work.
Great.
I do have some follow-up questions, though. So all of this has to do with deforestation in Indonesia. Without forcing you to play the game about why I should care about deforestation in Indonesia, Why should I care about deforestation in Indonesia?
People don't realize that when you look at the global greenhouse gas emitters, that there's China and U.S. at the top, and most people might guess those. But then the third is actually Indonesia. It's ahead of all the other big industrialized countries of the world. And the number one reason is deforestation. And the number one reason for that is this palm oil plantation expansion that's going on right now. So if you care about global warming or what that might mean for droughts and disease and sea levels rising and polar bears and the long list that we've all heard about, then you've got to care about what's happening in Indonesia right now.
What do you suggest? This stuff is apparently everywhere. It's in all kinds of products. It's marketed as something that's actually good and even green. How, if we avoid these products and demand goes down, does that really save orangutans?
Absolutely. It's a two-step process. I mean, obviously, people who buy products every day have a choice to make. And you can look on the ingredient labels, and if you see palm oil, you can try to avoid those products. There's a lot of other products out there that don't have palm oil in it that taste just as good, that work just as well. The second thing you do is contact companies and say, hey, I don't want any of your products with palm oil in it. And the third thing is that those companies, once they hear from consumers, can start to make choices about how they get their ingredients. They can say, we don't want palm oil from plantations that have recently been rainforests.
And we should say again, the American Palm Oil Council has a very different opinion. I mean, they clearly say that palm oil is not this evil. It actually is good for you. It's rich in all kinds of antioxidants and increases good cholesterol, that there are actually health benefits.
You know, people will always claim that their products are good for you. You can look at the cigarette manufacturers for years claiming that there was no link to cancer. The point is now that the writing is truly on the wall, and that, you know, from human rights abuses to species extinction to global warming, this is a problem we just can't afford to ignore.
And one of many. I mean, it's so tough to keep track of everything that you hear that's bad out there. How does palm oil stack up in your priorities or your organization's priorities?
Yeah, Greenpeace has offices all over the world. We're sort of unique that way. And when we look at the priorities for the global environment, palm oil is right up at the top of the list, believe it or not. And it's a relatively new phenomenon, so people are still learning about it. And when we look at what's going on worldwide, palm oil is one of the leading causes of that deforestation. It's something we can do something about relatively easily.
Well, you definitely made me care more than I did a couple of minutes ago about palm oil. Rolf Skaar is a senior forest campaigner with Greenpeace. Hey, thanks for being with us, Rolf. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Rachel.
Coming up, we'll get a look inside the tactics that John McCain will be employing on the campaign trail. He is the presumptive Republican nominee, but we presume nothing here at the BPP. We call Jonathan Martin of Politico. Next.
A family that cooks together stays together. At least that holds true for Patrick and Gina Neely. As co-owners of Neely's Barbecue, they've turned their family restaurants into one of the most successful barbecue chains in the South. They also host a TV show on the Food Network called Down Home with the Neelys. Pat and Gina are fun, folksy, and family-oriented. Pat started our chat by telling me how it all got started.
first of all, I was 23 years of age, and, you know, I always felt like, even back then, that the best thing I had going for me was my age, and the worst thing I had going for me was my age, because I was young enough to make mistakes, yet at the same time, I was going to be young enough to recover from them. So, you know, it was a very, very gutsy move, because he and I, we didn't have a quarter. And I'm sure you're saying, well, how did you open up a restaurant without any money? Well, my grandmother, who was in her 90s, was gracious enough and had enough faith and confidence in us to use our house as collateral. And we took out a small $20,000 loan, opened up a 2,000 square foot restaurant in 1988. And the first day we opened, we were dead broke. We didn't have a cash register. It was so many things that we didn't have that I wouldn't dare try to open up a restaurant in today's time without. But in less than the 2 years, we leased the building for 2 years. In 2 years, not only had we paid my grandmother her money back, but we had saved $40,000. And we took that money and used it as a down payment and purchased our first restaurant.
Well, you know, I want to go to you, Gina, because I understand that there was a reunion at which you two reconnected. Tell me about that, first of all.
Pat and I dated in high school. As a matter of fact, our parents went to the same high school. And we got back together. We dated all through high school. We broke up, of course, and then we got back together at our 10-year reunion.
Pat, do you ever think, oh, my gosh, I work with my wife, and now I'm under this microscope, you know, as we do the show? Or do you think it brings you closer together? How do you feel about all that?
Well, first of all, you know, Gina and I made a pact when she first started working in the restaurant, and this was a sincere pact, that if, in fact, it ever affected our marriage, that we would cease working together, because we've always felt like raising our girls, staying married, is the most important thing. I mean, we've often talked about, you know, the divorce rate is 50%, but we always said we were going to be that other 50%. And I must say, with this new venture, Gina and I, we really didn't have a whole lot of expectations as it relates to the Food Network. As a matter of fact, it wasn't something we pursued. It just so happened that they asked us. We said, well, we'll give it a shot. It turned out to be successful, and we're delighted based on that. As it relates to us being married, the best part about this entire show is the fact that I'm able to share it with her, and we're able to do it together. For so long, Gina felt like, well, I'm coming into the family business. It's you and your brothers. But let me tell you something. She came in with a bang, and she took care of business from day one. And so now that this is something that she and I can sink our teeth in, and she has as much of a partnership or a ownership of this whole show as I do, I'm thrilled. I'm more thrilled for Gina than I could ever be for myself.
A lot of folks see you as also role models for Black marriage, you know, holding up this idea based on what you said of really trying to be that other 50%, the 50% mm-hmm. that stays together. Gina, do you see yourself as a role model?
I'm not sure if I see myself as a role model. That, you know, I don't know if I want to hold up the whole, you know, African-American race as a whole. But I know for me personally, I think it is a great avenue to get our message out there. And it's sort of like a ministry to me, because the show has really been a blessing to my marriage. And what we're trying to show is that you can have a great marriage and have balance within your home and work together. And also, you know, people really see cooking as more of a duty, but I think if we can kind of see the love and the generosity that goes into that, and hopefully understanding that it represents a much bigger picture than the fact that it's a cooking show, but it also shows a very young couple working together, achieving something, and that you can have it all, and that you can work with your husband and have beautiful children and love as a whole.
I love that young couple. I love that comment. You know, we like to be considered a young couple.
But we are a young couple.
I don't know about role model and the word role model, but I like the word responsibility. And Gina mm-hmm. and I do feel a tremendous amount of responsibility in terms of the images we project, and the fact that hopefully, you know, we get letters all the time. And I think one of the nicest letters we received was from one of our fans that watched the show that says, you know, you guys have really enhanced my marriage. Mm-hmm. Me and my husband get in the kitchen, we cook, and we spend time together. And it's those type of testimonies that really motivate Gene and I and make us feel real good about what we're doing.
Right.
Now, I want you to make my taste buds jump. I am not in front of any of your food, but I want you to describe this dish that sounds so intriguing, barbecued spaghetti. What does that taste like?
Well, girl, when we get through, you're going to go get your plane ticket. You know
what I mean? Yeah.
You know, Gene and I came from very humble beginnings. We didn't have a whole lot, and we both came from large families. We both basically came from single parents. I mean, I lost my father at 11 to a massive heart attack. My mother was 39, and Gina's mother was divorced, and so she was in a family of five. I was in a family of six. And what that means, in particularly in the South on a limited income, is that you're going to eat at home a lot. So we ate home every day, and I came from a family of five boys, and my mother cooked all these big meals. I mean, stew and chili and meatloaf and roast beef, the big hearty meals. But one of the dishes that she cooked on a weekly basis was Italian spaghetti. You know, in our house, we would have to have a meat with spaghetti. I mean, a lot of people, that's the entree, but spaghetti was a side dish for us. So, you know, when me and my brother started in the restaurant business, there are over 100 barbecue restaurants here in the Memphis metropolitan area. And one of the things that we wanted to do was to separate ourselves a little bit by having signature dishes that no one else had or that we could put our own stamp on. So we started with this barbecue spaghetti, and we said, you know, we could pull out the tomato sauce mm-hmm. and add barbecue sauce, pull out the pulled pork, the ground beef and put pulled pork in it. Mm-hmm. So we would saute bell peppers and onions. We'd play around, and my uncle actually sold it in his restaurant. So when we started, but it was very early on, a few restaurants was doing it, but it didn't really have the substance like it has now. And ironically, when we first put this recipe together and tasted it, we said, man, this is going to be knockout. When people would come to the restaurant, they thought we had lost our minds. They were like, these guys have gone nuts. They're young. They don't know what they're doing. And they're selling barbecue spaghetti. And now it's running out. I mean, 60, 70 to 100 gallons per store per week. I mean,
wow.
we sell a lot of
right.
it. And it's a great item because what you have to do here in Memphis with barbecue being so prevalent is have a diverse menu. I mean, we do things like barbecue nachos. We do a Neely spud. You know, we do a barbecue salad. So mm-hmm. what we've tried to do is really diversify our menu, but do like McDonald's. Stay consistent with what you believe in. Don't start frying chicken and cooking collard greens.
Or making a burger.
You know, or even hamburgers. We don't even sell those. Stay with what you do. Do it well. But you can diversify it a little bit, and that's what we did. And it's a very, very popular item now.
Congratulations on all of the moves that you've been making.
Thank you so much. All
Please
right.
make your way
All
to
right.
Memphis before long.
I will. Keep the spaghetti warm for me. Pat and Gina Neely are co-owners of Neely's Barbecue. Some of their favorite recipes can be found at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. You can catch Down Home with the Neelys on the Food Network.